Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Fireground Strategies and Other Stuff from the Street with Anthony Avillo and Jim Duffy on Fire Engineering Talk Radio, where firefighters come to learn, share their knowledge, their experience, their opinions, and hopefully have a little bit of fun at the same time. So sit back and enjoy the show. And please, don't be afraid to call in if you have something to add to the discussion. Hey, welcome to November's edition of Fire Engineering Talk Radio, Fireground Strategies and Other Stuff from the Street with Anthony Avillo and Jim Duffy. And obviously, you probably know what we're going to talk about, being that Anthony lives in Jersey. I live in Connecticut, and I'm from Long Island, New York. The only thing we have to talk about is the storm. We survived relatively well. I have a lot of family members that are not doing so well, but they're getting better day by day. And Anthony, how's things down in your neck of the hurricane cleanup?
Well, it's basically just like yours. Some people did better than others. I have some family that didn't do so well, some people that did better than others, you know. But I guess these are things that we're going to discuss today on the show. And by the way, it's episode number 400.
Yeah, 400. I didn't have time again because, like I was just telling you just before the show started, out of the last week and a half or so, I've spent 5 or 6 days down on Long Island trying to help family out. So that's why we didn't do so much promotional. That's why the boring look of our talk radio thing. You know, I usually change it up, put different pictures up there, but I had no time. So, you know, people did what we did really, really well. And in Connecticut, because we got hammered by Irene last year, and that winter nor'easter we got hammered by, people actually listened to the fire service this time. They evacuated in Connecticut. In many other places on the Jersey Shore, the Long Island Shore, it didn't work so well. A lot of people were in their homes when the storm hit, and it wasn't really a pretty picture. But I've been down in Long Island. I was down there about 36 hours after the storm, helping my brother-in-law, who happens to be a firefighter in Brooklyn. And he was not in an evacuation zone. He was about 2 miles in from the shore, and there were some creeks and some bay areas coming up by him. About 11 o'clock at night, he looked outside, and he saw water was up to the wheels of one of his cars. And he turned around and talked to his wife and said, "Hey, we better get out of here." By the time she got the baby seat to go in the car, the water was up to the doors in his car. So they kind of said, "The heck with the baby seat." And that wasn't the exact word he used when he told me the story. But they got in the car, tried to get out, but a tree came down in front of them. They couldn't back up because the water was deeper behind them. And then he went around the tree and he headed up. You folks from Long Island who are listening, you know where I'm talking about, Long Beach Boulevard. He started heading north and there was a boat in his way. It was wrapped in that blue shrink wrap that they store boats in, and it was floating on the highway he was on, and water was coming in. He had no lights, no windshield wipers, and the airbags went off in the car from the electrical shorts going on, and he just kept hammering it through the water, and he met up with someone in a truck with a high lift, you know, one of those redneck vehicles. Anybody who's a redneck, I apologize. I mean it endearingly. But, you know, really high lift. And he got them out of there, and he got them up north away from the shore. He had a 10-week-old baby and his wife. And he said to me, he goes, "You know, I don't mind telling you, I was crying. I thought we were all going to die. I thought I was going to lose my new baby and my wife all in one quick shot." And he's a firefighter in Brooklyn. And he works in East New York, which is a ghetto, not a very nice neighborhood to work in. So, but he said he was so scared. But one of the good things about this, and something I try to remind you guys at every show, is that the Brotherhood and the Fire Service is absolutely amazing. Within 36 hours, I was there. 6 to 10 guys at different times from his company in Brooklyn were out at his house. We gutted his house. We got the hardwood floors up. We got the sheetrock out. We got the insulation out. And piled the furniture out in the back for the insurance to look at, and the garbage in the front. And because he was a firefighter, he had enough help. But if you looked on his street, the devastation and how horrible it was, the people were trying to do this themselves. You know, we could help a little bit with different people. But because he was a firefighter, he got all that stuff out before the mold started growing. Now all those people, they have a secondary issue that's going on. Mold is growing in all these houses. So it wasn't destroyed by the floods and the rain and the power outage. It's now being destroyed by mold. These houses are being covered with black mold. It's a pretty horrible thing to see. But I have to tell you, these people down in New York and on Long Island that I've had a lot of contact with in the last week, they're determined. They're coming back. They're fighting their way back. Most of my family, brothers and sisters, have no power. My sister got it back yesterday. I've been driving down there with gasoline and generators to lend to people I borrowed from guys I work with, because in Wallingford, where I work, we did pretty well. You know, it was a horrible night out at work, but once the morning came, we did well. You know, we had electricity, you know, some trees down. A couple miles south of us, where PJ Norwood lives in East Haven, it was another nightmare for them. But as PJ will tell you, or has told you if you listen to a show this week, that people got out, so the problems weren't as severe. And Anthony, I know where you are, you know, the Jersey Shore just north of you and south of you, it was hammered. And are right. Things looking better there?
Well, it's a really slow recovery. The day after the storm, my mom lives in Lake Como, which used to be South Belmar. It's right next to Belmar. And Lake Como, which is right across the street from a house, sort of catty corner, the ocean breached. There's a street between the ocean and the lake called, I think Ocean Avenue is the name of the street, and the ocean breached it. And the whole thing overflowed. All the houses were flooded, and the water stopped right in my mother's driveway. So they wound up only getting about 6 inches of water, but all the houses around them got a real lot of water. When I was up there that next day, we went to the Belmar Boardwalk, and the Belmar Boardwalk looked like a bomb hit it. The beach, it was like weird. Like it was, the beach was just... it was like there was a cliff of sand that dropped down to where the ocean level was. The whole beach had basically washed away, but it also tore up the boardwalk. And the sand, the properties that were across the street on Ocean Avenue, at that point were beachfront properties. The sand was right up to their doors. All the streets were flooded. And the restaurants and places like that were pretty much, you know, devastated. But, and that wasn't even as bad as some of the other places, like a little further south when you went into Lavalette and Normandy Beach and some places like that where Route 35 goes down. Anybody from the Jersey Shore knows this. There's maybe a quarter of a mile to the bay and a quarter of a mile to the ocean, and maybe a half of a mile in some places. But in some places like Mailoking, the ocean actually breached. And it breached right into the bay. It cut a new inlet. And just like in Brooklyn, they had a bunch of fires there. But there they had mansions. And about 20 mansions burned down. Going a little further north, Seagirt and Monmouth Beach, they were devastated. One of my favorite bars in the world, Donovan's Reef, was destroyed. Devastation along what they call the Barrier Islands down on the Jersey Shore. And it's going to be a really long time before these places are back to normal. I think the Army Corps of Engineers are going to have to go in and sort of maybe change the whole face of it. You know, it may not be the Jersey Shore like we know it. You know, and all, you know, Seaside Heights, Seaside Park, you know, all these places have just been devastated. And it's unbelievable, really, that, you know, a storm can have that type of magnitude. And I believe it was only and I hate to say only, but it was a Category 1 hurricane. I was looking at the wind speeds for Katrina coming into New Orleans, and they were like 200 miles an hour. This storm, I think, packed punches maybe 90, 95 miles an hour. Can you imagine double the wind speed and the devastation that that storm must have done? I couldn't even imagine it based on what I saw in this storm.
Yeah. What was unbelievable about this storm was the timing. It hit just as high tide. The storm surges. It wasn't the winds, and it wasn't even the rain that caused all our problems. Like what happened on Staten Island, it just pushed it all up in there. And where my brother-in-law was, it just pushed the water in. I don't know if you folks from the West Coast who are listening, you have to understand where Long Island is, Long Island Sound going into New York Harbor and all that area. It's surrounded on three sides, and the ocean is on the east side, and it just pushed it all up in there, and there was no place for the water to go. It was very, very different. And it was flooding, and anybody close to the ocean was flooded. As I was saying earlier, because of where I live, gas was plentiful. On Long Island, they had no power. The gas was there, but there was no power to pump the gas. So the few stations that had power, people were lining up, and they were draining their tanks in hours. Every time I went down there, I was bringing 25 gallons of gas in 5-gallon cans. Initially, I bought a generator to my sister. She's got three young children. I got her a generator, and I wired it up and helped her out. The next day, I borrowed a generator and brought it to my brother, and I borrowed another one and brought it to another friend. But gas was the big issue, you know, and so every time I went down, I brought gas. Where I lived, it was, you know, prices were actually dropping, and down there, it was, you know, 6-hour wait to get gas. So it was... I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. This was the United States of America in New York, and some of them, as a matter of fact, I was going through some of the most upscale neighborhoods on the north shore of Long Island, what they used to call the Gold Coast, that there were miles and miles and miles of electric cable laying in the street. And the firefighters, you know, and most of Long Island is all volunteer firefighters, they went in and they stayed 72, 80 hours, and then they switched. It was just... The fire service was just stepped up to the plate, as they always do. And, you know, the firehouses where people used to go for, like, when it was emergencies, they used to go to the firehouses, and that was kind of like a shelter. But they had, like, firefighters from Albany. When I was in Island Park by my brother's house, 36 hours after the storm, I met an urban search and rescue team from Indianapolis, Indiana. And what a great bunch of guys. I chatted with them briefly, and then I told them, you see that house down there, number 41? You go in there, and you walk in there, and you just yell, Brooklyn firefighters suck. So they go, okay. They walked up to the house, and they saw me. They looked around, and they said, there's too many of them, and they're too big. We're just going to move on to the next house. But what they were doing, they were going door-to-door to houses to make sure people were out and there was nobody living in those houses. And it was amazing. They were from Indianapolis. I was in Long Island, and they were there 36 hours later. The urban search and rescue teams were there from all over the country. They were all over Brooklyn, Breezy Point, Long Island, and I'm sure they were in Jersey. I just can't vouch for that.
Right. I'm not even sure. I know we got National Guard in Jersey going down, you know, right now. They're actually still in different places. I'm not really sure. To be honest with you, I saw, you know, I mean, the New Jersey USAR teams, the Swiftwater team, all that, they were all in place. But I'm not so sure how much outside help we got from different fire departments. You know, I'm just not aware of it. There is a lot of, like, task force deployment throughout Monmouth County and Ocean County, where departments are sort of rotating down into the Barrier Island areas and, you know, sort of covering for them. My union, the FMBA, is organizing and sending people down. For instance, today they were down in Toms River. Toms River is just next to Carnegie Bay. A lot of damage down in that area. It's sort of on the eastern shore of Toms River. Is on Barnegat Bay, and then you cross the bay and you're on the Barrier Island. So they had a lot of damage down there. And I know some of the firefighters were operating like a soup and coffee wagon down in one of the strip malls. And then tomorrow we're scheduled to go down into Seabright and Monmouth Beach and you know, they basically said, look, get your, get, you know, old clothes out, work gloves, and be ready for manual labor, because that's basically what we're doing. We've had a lot of firefighters lose houses. Some of them, they're secondary houses down by the beach, but some of them, they're primary houses, a couple of them in Weehawken, which the west end of Weehawken. Weehawken is on the Hudson River, part of it. So is West New York and North Bergen. All that area flooded out. A lot of it is, again, they call that the Gold Coast. A lot of condos and things like that. And they were told to evacuate. Many of them, of course, chose not to. And one of the firefighters was talking about it through, this is a secondary story, that they didn't think that the water would get that far. And they went down to the end of the block and saw the water coming, ran down into, like, there's this little area in Weehawken called the Shades, and it's below the cliffs. And it's a very close knit community. And these guys were down there screaming at everybody, get out, get out. And they said before they knew it, the water was like, you know, 4, 5, 6 feet deep. And the fire department, I believe, evacuated about 350 people out of the Shades. Boats.
Make sure you let people know that that's the North Hudson Regional Fire Department that evacuated. Weehawken is part of Anthony's department. He's a regional fire department. So it's not another city. That's the city he works in. That's where Anthony's the deputy chief. I don't know whether everybody knows that, that Weehawken is part of your regional fire department.
Everybody knows that. What are you kidding me? We're on the map.
Do you think the guys listening from Ohio or from Indiana know anything about Jersey? Jersey's not as big as you guys over there think it is.
Hey, listen, you know what? Across this country, there are guys on North Hudson Regional and guys that wish they were on North Hudson Regional. Anyway, that's an argument we'll have for another show. But, but we had a lot of damage up north. As a matter of fact, my cousin lives in Moona, in Little Ferry. Little Ferry is west of North Hudson. It is sort of right where the Meadowlands are, where Giant Stadium is, well, MetLife Stadium now, but where Giant Stadium is and Jimmy Hoffa's buried and all that. But they had a levee break on the Hackensack River, and the floods came into Little Ferry, Moonaki, and I believe Carlstadt, and my cousin lives on one of the streets. He said the water came through the window like the Titanic. It broke through the windows, and he had water it was up to his shoulders, and they had to get boated out of there. And there's still areas up there that still have no power. And I know there's an issue. You know, the whole Long Island thing. There's still no power on a lot of parts of Long Island, correct?
Yeah, I was. Like I said, I've been down there a lot because that's obviously where I was born in Queens, raised on Long Island. It's coming back slowly, but now the people on the real South Shore. The ocean water was so high into the electrical panels and into the boiler rooms that they all have to be inspected before they can turn the power. There's been a lot of issues. And, of course, there's anger at the power companies. But I tell you what, when I went down there 36 hours after the storm, I thought it would be months before they had power. They had over a million customers without power, a million. You know, think about that. They're down to like 10% are out now. And I think it's amazing. And I know people are angry and people are pissed and they don't have power right now. And I don't believe it's not because they're working hard. I saw linemen from everywhere down there. I saw people from Pennsylvania. I saw people from Georgia. I saw lighting company trucks from Illinois. I mean, they're working, but the damage was just so incredible. I have to say, I'm pretty impressed with the work. And in Connecticut, I think there's like less than 100 people without power right now. There were some people who lost power in the snowstorm that came a couple, about a week and a half later, lost power on top of it. But they learned. In Connecticut last year when Irene came through, it was horrible. I personally was out 7 days the first time and 4 days the second time. And they ramped up, they came through, they cut the trees away from the wires, and they actually, in Connecticut, they had utility companies coming in 2 days before the storm from out west and up north. So,
well, they did that for Irene, too. I remember I was in St. Louis.
Well, in Connecticut, they didn't do it for Irene. They neglected to do it for Irene.
When I was driving back from St. Louis last year, there was a convoy of utility trucks heading east, Where they were going, I don't know, but there were literally thousands of them.
Yeah, but they were after. At Irene, it was after the fact. This time they
front-loaded. No, it was before the storm. We were heading back from St. Louis, and this was 2 days before the storm because I had to be back because I was acting chief. And as we were going back, the majority of the vehicles heading east were utility trucks.
Yeah, they weren't in Connecticut, though.
Well, it's funny. We had this one. This storm was not quite the rain event that, that Irene was. You know, Irene was a huge, huge rain event in New Jersey. And we had, I wound up getting water in my basement, having to rip my whole basement out because I had no generator. This storm actually did have a generator, and my sump pump basically never went off. It worked out okay, you know. But, so we lost power for 5 days here in Freehold. And, I had my mom and my stepfather and my mother-in-law here, and, you know how that goes.
Tell me how that goes.
Well, you know what? Not that it was bad or anything, but, you know, I had not lived under the same roof with my mother in about 25 years, you know, maybe more, maybe 35 and 30. And, it takes a little bit of getting used to, you know.
It sure does. I was talking about my brother-in-law, Matt. He's living with Maureen, my wife's sister, right now. But at one point, her parents were there. My brother-in-law, Matt, and his new baby. Other kids, I think they had like 13 people living in a small ranch. Actually, it was a small cape. You know, it was just like unbelievable. But here's what's going on down on Long Island and in New York City, and I'm sure all over New Jersey. My brother-in-law has family. The people I know have family, and they're all been moving up. There are people who, you know, moved here from out west or from down south or from other countries. They don't have any places to go. There are people. My sister, Katie, who lives on Long Island, actually all my family lives on Long Island, but they've been bringing food down to people in Long Beach because they have no place to live. I read a thing in the New York Times today. There are people going to the bodegas, and those of you who don't know what a bodega is, it's like an inner city deli. It's an everything store. They've been going there with bottles and filling them. They're giving most of the bodegas that have power are giving away free hot water, or most of the convenience stores are giving away free hot water. They're filling jugs with hot water, and they're wrapping themselves in blankets in these jugs to keep warm at night. And I can't even imagine. These are people that live in, you know, $300,000 homes the day before the storm. They're afraid to leave. They have no place else to go. They're hardworking people, and it's just like nobody expected it. And some of them, they won't move. Where my brother-in-law lives, actually, there's a woman across the street. She's got a toddler, and she says, "I'm not going to go live in a shelter. I have to take care of my four." I said, "You know what? You have a 4-year-old. You need to go where there's heat and food." And people, you know, they have their own biases and their own misconceptions. It's safer for them to be in those places, but they're afraid to go to the shelters. So they're literally filling water bottles and wrapping themselves in blankets and hot water bottles. And this is not in the mountains in the Ozarks where they're unemployed. It's not in the Bowery in New York City or any other impoverished area in the world. This storm brought everybody down to the least common denominator. Everybody is equal. It did not choose race. It did not choose financial ability. It's devastated. I'm actually hoping a really good friend of mine who was on Staten Island during the height of the storm. I hope he calls in. He's a lieutenant, normally in squad 18. He is, they were detailed to the Swiftwater Rescue, but they went in and they were expecting to evacuate people. But by the time they got there, water was up to the doors in the trucks. And these, what I'd like him to talk about is the accountability, where firefighters working in 4 to 8 feet of water all of a sudden lost radio contact with each other. How do you account for your crews when you've got 6 people with you and all of a sudden there's no more radio communication? It's dark out and you're up to your waist or sometimes your chest in water. And he's working tonight, and he says he's going to try to call in and tell us some of what went on down there. But they were going, buildings were burning, and they were rescuing people off the roofs next door to burning buildings. They were just letting buildings burn. And this is a mile and a half inland from where the water should be on Staten Island. And Staten Island is still devastated. Breezy Point, I'm sure you all saw the videos of Breezy Point on the Rockaway Peninsula in New York. They lost 100-plus houses to fire because they couldn't find the hydrants. The water was too deep to get the engines there. And the interesting thing about Breezy Point is it's a lot of firefighters, police, retired firefighters and police. These homes have been owned for generations by the same family. And, you know, it was devastating. You know, they watched whole neighborhoods burn. It was almost like a wildland firefight. You know, you draw a line in the sand, where are you going to stop it? And those of you who live in the middle of the country have to, Breezy Point is like a little peninsula coming off of Queens and Brooklyn on the south west portion of Long Island. And people who live there say it's not Long Island, but it is Long Island. But it's part of Queens and Brooklyn down there. And it's just a thin strip of land. You would probably call it a sandbar in many places. But there were homes that were built there at the turn of the century. And a lot of the land there is just leased, not even owned by the homeowners. It's owned by the city. And people like third and fourth generation living in these homes. And they're gone. And the ones that weren't burned, I have a friend whose their house washed away. It wasn't where the fire was, but the ocean just said, you know what, you're not staying here anymore, and took the home and flushed it away. And the fire department, the jobs that they did were absolutely incredible. They couldn't save all the homes, and they obviously couldn't save all the people, especially on Staten Island. A lot of people drown in their own homes. But the valiant efforts by the firefighters that were on duty in those places, to me, is absolutely incredible. Again, I'm humbled by what they had to do that night. You know, I was working that night, and I was scared in my own little world, you know, with transformers blowing up and standing out in the high wind. But these people were standing up into their waist and chest sometimes in water, in the dark, with no radio communication.
Right.
You know, that's...
Right. Yeah, it was crazy. It was, you know, sort of like, you know, out of like science fiction for a lot of people. Because it was just, people could not believe that the storm did get that bad, you know. But, you know, and then one of the other things that occurred was, you know, people were told to leave. And, you know, I think one of the reasons people don't want to leave is number one, because they have nowhere to go. Number two, they're afraid that the house is going to be looted. And they don't want their homes looted, you know. So it's, you get into this weird catch-22 thing. And this is where, you know, people got themselves in trouble in this particular storm. One of the things that I remember them saying, and actually I think it was Governor Christie that said it, and not that I'm not a fan of him at all, but I got to say I thought he did a very good job during the storm being visible and doing all, I thought he did all the right things. And I can't believe I'm saying that, but...
Me either.
But one of the things he said was, you know what, we're telling you to leave, we're warning you to leave, because we do not want to put first responders' lives at risk coming in to get you. Because if we have to come in and get you, now we're putting more people's lives at risk, and we don't need to do that. And that's what people have to understand about when they're told to evacuate. It's not necessarily just their lives that are in jeopardy. And, you know, it's their property, obviously, but it's not necessarily just their lives. It's the lives of the first responders now that are going to risk their lives to come in and get them. Over Breezy Point, too, didn't New York City lose a couple of rigs in those fires, too? They had to abandon the rigs that water come in
so
fast?
They did. And some of them that they're not even talking about, there are rigs that were just lost because the floodwaters came up so literally like a toe of Staten Island. They were going to evacuate people, and they thought the water was still at street level. And within minutes, like you said about the Meadowlands, within minutes, it was door high.
Right.
Even the best forecasters did not realize that this was going to happen. On Staten Island, a mile and a half inland, they actually just opened the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel today, and they only opened one side of it. In the morning, it's westbound into Manhattan, and in the evening, it's eastbound out to Brooklyn and Long Island. It took 2 weeks to pump. It took 2 weeks to pump all that water out. They also opened the Long Beach branch of the Long Island Railroad, which is part of the commute into the city. It's one of the largest commuter rails in the country. They just opened today, too. And we're on day 16, I believe, from the storm, and they're just getting these things open.
Right. And that's because they had that much water in the tunnel, huh?
Yeah, the tunnel was actually filled. Both tubes of the tunnel were filled. There's normally an eastbound tube, three lanes, and a westbound tube, three lanes. And they filled. They were filled up. The PATH trains were filled up, too.
Yeah, that I know. And it's amazing because the Lincoln Tunnel was the only tunnel that was kept open. I don't know why, but, if you look at that tunnel, it looks like the water would just flow down right into it. That's like a downhill run as well. But for some reason, I guess that tunnel was survived,
yeah.
So to speak.
Those of you folks listening, what Chief Avila was talking about, it's the Lincoln Tunnel and the Hudson Tunnel that goes from Manhattan to New Jersey. The Brooklyn Battery Tunnel obviously goes from Battery is the south end of Manhattan, Battery Park. It's where the World Trade Center is. It goes from there out to Brooklyn and Long Island. So these tunnels are, I don't know, a million people go through them every day on a normal work week. So you have to understand the impact.
Huge transportation hubs.
Yeah, so I understand, you know, people who live out west can't comprehend how Manhattan works and how all this is interconnected. You know, when did the Staten Island Ferry and those ferries going from New Jersey and New York start running again?
Oh, I believe they're running. I believe that all the ferries are running. I think they were back in service maybe like a week later. My kids just went back to school this past Monday. They were out of school for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Soccer was canceled and cheer competition was actually canceled, which they never canceled. It just stopped this whole area in its tracks. I mean, I got to tell you, talk about the gas. It took me 6 hours to get gas about 2-3 days after the storm. The parkway lines were unbelievable because nobody had power, you know. But, now what they're talking about, and I really think that if in New Jersey and New York they mandated gas stations to have generators, I think it would have helped out a lot. Not only the gas stations, but the places that the storage facilities that pump the gas into the trucks, they should have backup generators. That should be mandated. I'm pretty sure it's mandated in Florida. It should be mandated here, too, because I believe my feeling is if there was enough gasoline to go around, there were certainly enough people with generators, and I think it would have made it a little less uncomfortable for people.
Yeah. Well, I told you, I made 3 trips of over 100 miles to deliver generators to friends and family on Long Island. And with it, I brought gallons of gas. And still, I am absolutely amazed at the devastation. So, you know what? We're talking about what happened, what's going on. Let's talk about plans. And I know your community is right on the Hudson River and pretty close to the bullseye where that was supposed to hit. I know it hit a little further south than you. But what kind of plans? Did you bring extra people on? Did you bring different rigs in? What did North Hudson Fire Department? I know you were on vacation, so you weren't there when this happened. But what did your department do to prepare for this storm?
Well, I actually spent the last storm, I spent 48 hours at the regional. It was a much bigger rain event, and I think that was a bit of an issue. But what we did was we put together a plan where normally we ride 10 engines, 4 ladders, and a rescue. We put, I believe, an additional 4 engines, another ladder, another rescue, an additional deputy, an additional battalion. We sort of ran a task force on the waterfront.
Like a swift water rescue team?
Operational task force.
Okay.
You know, like fire department task force. But the one thing we did do, which was I thought was the best thing that we did, was we put recon squads in place. and we put one in each battalion. And the recon squads in them, they have, you know, lights and chainsaws and fire extinguishers and, you know, pipe poles and just the basics. And what those recon companies would do is they would be the first responders to the wires down and the trees down and that sort of thing. And it sort of took some of the heat off of the companies that were running around to, like, you know, gas leaks and alarm activations and ceiling collapses and all that. And it worked out really well. The only thing that we found in Hurricane Irene with this issue was the guys on those recon squads got the crap beat out of them. So what we did, about 2 months later, we had another storm after Irene. It was very similar to the snowstorm we just had, where still a lot of leaves on the trees, and we had trees down and wires down. And what we did was we rotated, and we put those companies off duty, basically out of service for 2 hours each at a time, just to give them a break. And that seemed to work. I'm not sure what they did in this storm, but those little recon units that they put in, you know, like Suburbans and small little vans, was you know, they had pumps with them as well. It worked out really, really well. I believe we did, I'm going to say, somewhere when I left work before the hurricane, we were about, I don't know, about 5,100 runs. When I came back in after the hurricane, I think we were somewhere around 5,900. So we did about 800 runs, which, you know, might not seem like a lot, but for us, it is absolute constant activity going, you know, day and night.
And, did you open up an EOC?
Well, our headquarters sort of became the EOC because we're a regional department, you know.
No, but what about police and public works and that kind of stuff? Did you have an emergency operations center where they all had like one figurehead in one place?
I don't think so during the storm. I don't know. You know, it's weird as a regional department, we're a little bit out of the loop from each individual town. Like, we're in the loop and out of the loop at the same time. I'm not really sure exactly how that worked out. But, you know, I do know that we were, like, extremely, extremely busy, you know, crazy busy, and all the power was out. So they had, you know, no dispatching capabilities, so they were listening on the radio. Hoboken, for the second storm in a row, their dispatching center went underwater. So, you know, I can't believe that they haven't done anything since Irene to make it a little bit better. You know,
you maybe they can move inland a little bit or upland a little bit?
On concrete blocks or something, I don't know. But Hoboken got beat up really badly. But I believe they got beat up badly. We had to send two rigs into Hoboken that they used, and we were sending down a couple of guys each day to show for those rigs. Because Hoboken was using all rigs. They were also dispatching out of North Hudson, which they did in the long storm as well. So and just another step towards regionalization for them. I always tell those guys, one day you're going to come in, it's going to say North Hudson across the front of your rigs, and you're going to have no idea where it came from, and it's just going to come.
Resistance is futile.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, for them right now, I mean, they like to maintain their autonomy and their identity as Hoboken, but I think it would be smarter for them to either come into North Hudson or into Jersey City. It would just make more sense for them. But, you know, I'm sure I'm going to get a slew of, like, people screaming at me about that statement. But, you know, that's just what I believe. I believe it would be safer and a much more efficient operation for them to, you know, because they're in between, you know, the second and the third largest departments in the state.
Right.
And
now, they're about, what, about 100 members or 110 members?
Somewhere around 100. I mean, listen, you know, good department, do good work. But, you know, it's there's clearly some change that needs to happen down there. They're dispatchers. They dispatch, like civilian dispatch like us. And when we opened our new dispatching center, from what I understand, and I mean, I don't know, I'm probably getting myself in trouble talking.
Yeah, really. Maybe we should cut off right now. Let's talk about Wallingford.
All right. Well, anyway, listen, the storm that, you know, was worse in some areas, especially where I live. We lost more trees in Freehold in that freak snowstorm that occurred you know, 4 or 5 days later, we got 13 inches of snow here.
Yeah. Wow. And in November in southern Jersey or central Jersey, you had 13 inches of snow. I had 10 here, but it was gone 2 days later.
Yeah, it was gone, but what happened was it was such a heavy snow, and
the leaves still on the trees.
Leaves still on the trees. It was very similar to the storm we had last October.
Yeah, it was Halloween.
Still, again, maybe a month or so, a month and a half after Irene, the leaves still on the trees, trees that were still, weak from Irene, and we had a lot of trees down and a lot of wires down, and people were losing power again, you know. So that was, sort of, and I felt, you know, for the people that had lost everything, it was like insult to injury a little bit, you know.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
One
of the things I noticed about this storm, because this is 2 years in a row, we've gotten hammered. If you plan and you prepare, and if they ask you to evacuate and you evacuate, things go much smoother. We brought in extra people. We opened up an EOC. What we had, Public Works was all in. They brought them in, the people who normally plow the streets and mow the grass in the fields and the schools and all that, the people who maintain the roads. We had them come in. We actually had a pickup truck with chainsaws set to respond with us, although we also ourselves put a chainsaw on engines. Normally, you know, saws are on trucks. We have a cutoff saw on our engines, a small cutoff saw, so when we have a car fire, we can cut right into the engine compartment. But we put chainsaws on all our engines. We had Public Works was responding in a four-wheel drive pickup truck. We needed to clear streets to get the fires or even emergency medical calls. They were there to help us. We had them on standby. We had, an EOC. So if myself as a incident commander can say, hey, I need a Public Works truck with a plow to clear the streets so we can get our engine in, we could get them there. We were very lucky. Like I said, 5 miles south of us, it was devastation, but where we worked, it just seemed like God looked at us and said, no, Wallingford's not going to get balled. But you could get the electric companies, you could get gas companies. And the communication, if you pre-plan how you're going to work together, it will make the job a lot easier. If you wait until the last minute and say, oh, maybe, you know, who do I call at Public Works? Or who do I call at the electric company to make this happen? If you have that all prearranged and you plan and you do a drill, and you work together and you get to meet people, it'll make your job easier when these unbelievable events occur. I know in Oklahoma, they don't get hurricanes, but they get what I think is far worse. They get tornadoes that come through and devastate whole neighborhoods. GPS is really important. I told you my friend on Staten Island, he had no idea where he was at some point, but GPS is in the rigs. You know, if you have a tornado and you're driving down the street and you see a medical emergency or a fire and all the landmarks have been washed away or blown away by a tornado, if you have a GPS, you can at least give them GPS coordinates so they can find where this emergency is. There's a lot you can do up front to help make this successful. It'll never be a good thing, but we as first responders and fire department need to be prepared to take care of these issues. And if we don't have a plan how to handle them, we're going to end up in trouble and playing catch up. And hope is not a plan. And too many of us, well, hopefully it's not going to be too bad. We don't need to get police cooperation because we don't like the police. Well, you know, the public works director, you know what? I don't like him. So we're not going to have him at the EOC or where I work, not where I live, but where I work. I'm very lucky. We have a city-owned utility that does the electrical work. So if I call as an incident commander and say, I need the electric division here, no matter what they're doing, they're coming to where I come. But if you work CLMP or PSE&G, is that what it is in Jersey? PSE&G?
You have PSE&G, and you have Jersey Central Power and Light. You have Atlantic City Power, I believe. There's a lot of different ones.
Yes. Well, whatever they are, they're private contractors, you know, or in New York City, it's Con Ed. They're still private contractors. I am fortunate. If if I say I need them priority or urgent, I go to the top of the list. That's one of the things good about a public-owned utility. So where I work, I'm very blessed. Where I live in the sticks, and it's a whole different story. It's Connecticut Light and Power, and you know what? We're going to be nice, and we're not even going to talk about them. But bottom line is, you have to pre-plan these things. You can't wait to the day of a hurricane, the day of a tornado, or the day of an earthquake if you're on the West Coast to decide to learn how you're going to work together. We actually had, because the way they were predicting the storm to be, we actually had a couple off-duty firefighters who actually carpenters build us storm shutters to put over our windows in the firehouse at headquarters. I think that was a little bit of overkill because obviously we never used them. And we spent overtime money, which the city doesn't really like us to do anyway, on building shutters. But, you know, one of the deputy chiefs thought it was an important thing to do, and we did it. And fortunately, we didn't need it. Now we have these shutters down in the lower truck room that I'm going to use to build a maze for training. So you have to pre-plan. You can't just
adapt to that.
You can't await for the storm to show up and say, oh, shit, we didn't think about the boats. We didn't think about the generators. We didn't think about the trailer park that's right on the river. You know, can you imagine, you know, 500 people calling you in a trailer park on the river saying we need to be evacuated and you didn't prepare for it? You have to pre-plan. You know, just like a fire, if you have pre-plans, it makes the job easier. If a disaster like this or a storm like this coming to your neighborhood, your fire district, your fire department, or your city, you can't wait till that day or even the day before to make these plans. You need to meet with your police department, your public works department, your electric suppliers, whoever they may be, and make plans how you're going to make this work. Because if you've got a house fire and you can't get to it because there's wires down and you don't have a plan on how to contact your electric company, somebody's going to die. And hopefully it's not one of our firefighters. We did lose a firefighter here in Connecticut during the hurricane. It was very sad story. They were on their way to an alarm, and a tree fell on the engine and kind of crushed the front of the engine. One of the lieutenants got out to try to clear the tree from the front of the truck, and another tree fell on him, massive head trauma, and he died very shortly thereafter in the hospital. It was a very sad thing. I'm not saying that planning would have prevented it, but, you know, there was a man who was trying to go out and do his thing and protect the public, and a tree fell on him. And it's not something we think about in line of duty death, there's trees falling on you, but it's a very real possibility in hurricanes and tornadoes.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you have trees down. I mean, you always hear in the stories of people, you know, getting killed from trees landing on the cars, and, you know, it's just being in the wrong place at the wrong time. But, you know, listen, our job is we put ourselves in harm's way, you know, and, you know, the reality of it is that when these storms hit, we should be the only ones out in the street. We should be the only ones in the areas that are dangerous. And if there's no people in those areas, well, then we can make a better, you know, risk assessment of, you know, whether we want to go into those areas and operate or not. But when, you know, unfortunately, when people do stay and sort of put themselves in harm's way, they put us in harm's way. You know, but you're right. The planning issue is such a big deal. And, you know, this was the 100-year storm. So hopefully, you know, departments take a real hard look at how they operated, how their planning went, what they could do better. Because, you know, for the next storm, and listen, we've had two big storms 2 years in a row. For the next storm, you know, maybe we're more prepared and, you know, maybe it's not as bad. I'd rather have some overkill. I'd rather be overprepared than underprepared. And I think that might be one of the things we're going to see, like for the next storm. But, you know, again, it's you know, as time goes by and people, you know, oh, we'll never be that bad. You know, how could it be that bad? Because that was some of the mentality we had, you know. And then the people that hold the purse strings, you know, sometimes they say, ah, it's not going to be that bad. And they, you know, sort of downplay the staffing issues and the equipment issues, and then before they know it, it's too late. And unfortunately, it's very, very hard to play catch-up during a storm like that one.
Can't. You absolutely cannot. We had just south of where I lived is a community called Old Saybrook. Catherine Hepburn had a house down there. She's no longer with us. But they had areas. There were houses burning, and the fire department was watching them with binoculars because they couldn't get there with their truck. They actually tried to get a 6x6, a military vehicle, to go down there, but the water was so high that these houses, they didn't burn to the ground. They burned to the waterline. Staten Island. My friend that worked on Staten Island, they watched houses burn to the waterline. They didn't, and, you know, have him describe this to me. They watched, because they couldn't find hydrants. They couldn't get engines in. They obviously couldn't get trucks in. They rescued people off roofs with ladders and got them out of there into boats and moved them away. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, you have to do, like you said, risk assessment. Well, guess what? Your house is going to burn to the waterline. I'm sure they weren't thinking that when it happened, but it was unprecedented. These people I've been speaking to over the last couple of days, I just taught in Tarrytown, New York, which is on the Hudson River on the opposite side of you, a little further north. It's actually right at the Tappan Zee Bridge. And some of the, you know, I talked to a lot of people of what was going on in their area. And you have to change everything you ever believed about firefighting, search and rescue, and taking care of the public. There's a point where they didn't leave, and it sounds like I'm being, you know, like I don't care. Nobody cares more than me about the public. But there's a point where they were asked to leave. They didn't evacuate. Water is 8 feet high at their house, and their house is on fire. And there's nothing we can do. Our engines don't float. Our men don't float. We'll do our best. They brought boats in. They got people out. They put ladders to roofs. And they found dead bodies in people's living rooms because they drowned in their own homes. You know, Staten Island, I don't even know what the number is right now, how many people died on Staten Island, how many people died in Breezy Point, how many people died on Long Island because they didn't leave. In Connecticut, I have to say, because of Irene last year, we did well. They watched houses burn. Greenwich, Connecticut, a very wealthy community on the southwest portion of Connecticut. At one point, I think it was about 11 o'clock at night, they said, fire dispatch to all units operating in Greenwich, return to the closest firehouse. They shut down operations. They brought them all back because the winds were so high and it was so dangerous out there. They brought them back. Mansions burned, and many of them in Old Saybrook, they let houses burn. In Staten Island, they let houses burn because they just couldn't do it. And I think pre-planning is the issue here.
Right. Well, you also have to sort of set that, to save people from
Anthony,
themselves.
You're breaking up.
Am I? How about now? Better?
Nope, you're breaking up.
Any better?
A little, but not good.
All right, hang on. I'm gonna go upstairs. Can you hear me better now?
Yeah, you sound like R2-D2, though.
Okay. That must be my cold. I have an R2-D2 cold.
No, it's definitely not you. It's definitely electronic.
How about now?
A little better.
A little better? Yeah,
oh,
I'm
now,
up
there.
I'm
you
up
go.
There.
Got it. To our listeners, I do apologize because we're using the internet and we're using cell sites to make this work. So I apologize. Anthony, you're doing much, much better. As long as we stop there.
Here?
Yes, I think it's time for our trivia question.
Okay. All right. I got one. Hopefully someone can get this one now. Now, my computer's downstairs now, Jimmy, so I'm off the computer. I'm just on the phone. Here's the trivia question. Ladder operations. There's a type of ladder raise called a church raise. In addition to a ladder, what other equipment do you need to pull up a church raise?
Wow. Anthony, you stumped me. I'm very disappointed now. I usually know everything.
Nah, come on. We actually did it. When I was in Weehawken, Ed Flood, who became chief of North Hudson, he's like my mentor. He was my captain. And that was when the IFSTAs were around. And we would go through the salvagist IFSTA. We go through the ladder IFSTA. And we would go through, like, there were the special uses for ladders. There was the special salvage operation. We would do all those things. All these weird, like the Venturi siphon. You ever hear of Venturi siphon?
Oh, that I could. That, you know what? I work in a district that 10% of the town has no hydrants, so I do know how that works. I came from New York,
yeah,
and I had no idea how that worked till I moved to Connecticut.
Well, it's with the hard suction, and you hook up a 2.5 to it, and you shoot water into the hard suction, and it creates a Venturi and pulls the water out of an area. It's really, really cool, and it works really, really well.
You can actually use an inch and 3/4 also, and it works.
Oh, really? We used to use it in Weehawken in the shades that used to flood, and it flooded in this storm, and they definitely wouldn't have used it. I don't think a Venturi siphon would help, but... We did all kinds of cool things. There was a thing called the ladder drawbridge that we did. So you get a chance, like if anybody's out there and you got some old Ipsters, not the essentials, but each like chapter of the essentials had its own book. There were some really cool things that you can do that actually I've probably done most of them along my career, and it makes you look like a genius. It really is really, it's working outside the box, which is a ladder company guy. That's your responsibility, to be able to work outside the box. But it's pretty cool. But does anybody have the answer to this, Jimmy?
No one's chiming in on a church raise. But you're going to excuse me for a second because I have to make a pit stop where I'm at. But I'm going to check something. Keep talking about all these raises, and I'll be right back.
Okay. The IFSTAs, it's... really, really valuable. There were all different types of alternative activities you can do with different types of tools. And like I said, we tried them all. We used most of them. We've used at one time or another on the fire ground. And it's all about ability to adapt your tools. We used to also do a thing called the roof pack, which we used to take up to the roof. And when we regionalized, it sort of got away from us, and everybody used to look at it like they were afraid of it. You know, nobody ever wanted to take it off the rig. And what the roof pack was, it was a halligan, a pick head axe, a pike pole, and two lengths of utility rope coiled for service. And the rope would be threaded over the pike pole and the halligan and the utility, which were all mated together. And we used to put it together with a rope sling, but what we did is we took a... one of those high-rise hose bundle things, you know, with Velcro on it, and we put that around it and put it on your shoulder. The guys would hold the high-rise packs with it. We would hold the roof pack with it. And it was a great tool. Actually, the first article I ever did in fire engineering was an article on the roof pack. You're probably going to the archives and find it. But
how long ago was that, sir?
1999.
1999 was your first article.
Yeah.
I'm gonna write that down for our next trivia.
What?
Our next trivia question next month. When was Chief Avillo's first article in fire engineering? It was 1999.
Yeah.
God,
so nobody said the church raise, huh?
No, nobody knows a church raise. Hey, listen, while we're talking, does anybody out there know what happened in Indianapolis with that explosion? I've been trying to find details. And they've all been very, very vague. Does anybody know what happened? If you
was
do,
that
either
a phantom explosion?
They're guessing a gas explosion, but there's been no details coming in, and I've been trying to figure that out because that was pretty devastating.
Yeah, they basically said that they really had no idea how this explosion occurred, and obviously it's being investigated, but it had, you know, some of the indications of a gas explosion or a propane explosion or whatever, there were none of those indicators there, supposedly. If this is the explosion that I'm thinking about, because I saw something on the news about it last night, and it was very interesting that, you know, usually they have an idea, but this one is saying they have no idea.
Nope, zero.
Yeah.
Just to repeat the question, what is a church raise?
No, that's not the question.
No?
No, the question was, in order to perform a church raise,
right,
you need two pieces of equipment. One of them's a ladder. What's the other one?
Well, my guess, and I know I shouldn't be guessing, so I'm not going to. But
yeah,
I have
nobody
a guess.
Else answering the question. You might as well get the DVD.
I've got them all, though.
You know, it's amazing.
I'm thinking of rope.
3 months in a row.
I'm thinking of rope.
You're thinking right.
Now,
what
do you,
right.
What do you raise it over a high point and pull it up? Is that how it works? Why don't you describe a church raise to us?
Basically, what the church raise is, and maybe some other people, I've heard it called an auditorium raise. This is where the ladder is raised straight up in the air. It's got a rope, four ropes. It's almost like using a ladder like a gin pole.
Like and a banger ladder? Like a banger ladder or a tormentor ladder?
In a way. But the four ropes being held taut is what keeps the ladder straight up in the air. And I'm going to tell you what, I did this in Weehawken. In the middle of the parking lot, we put up a 35-foot ladder, and we had four guys on the ropes, and I climbed it to the top. And, you know, that's trust. That's trust. One guy doesn't hold properly, that ladder's going. And to this, you know, here I am 28 years into my career, and I got to just say to myself, what the heck was I thinking about?
Yeah. We actually tried something similar, and like we would never use it in a real incident, but we actually built on the back of an engine, we used a ladder, and we use it as an off-center lift point to lift something or to raise something. We made almost like a crane we made out of it. It was like a gin pole, exactly. And,
yeah.
I would, as an incident commander, I hope I never have to use this, but we checked it out, and it does work. But
it works. I remember.
It's scary.
We did it one time in a class or something, and it didn't work that well. The whole thing is the center of balance has to be proper, or the thing kind of falls apart. And when we did it in a class one time, it didn't work that well. But I got to tell you, this church raise worked great. I couldn't believe how well it worked, and it worked so well that I actually climbed the ladder. You know, and I went up 35 feet, and I was at the top of the ladder. But that's what a church raise is. And, you know, I've heard it's called an auditorium raise or a balcony raise or
now,
something like that.
Now, you had a high-angle rescue and the person was down off the cliff, you couldn't get close enough to build a good thing. Could you use it to go over the side of a cliff or something? So two of the ropes would be holding all the weight. You know, just like an off-center or cantilevered load, would it work?
I don't know. You know, I would think if you were, I never even considered that you anchor the lifeline off, anchor it to the top of a ladder, put the ladder over, and have somebody climb down that ladder, and then grab somebody like a pickoff. I don't know. In theory, that might actually work.
Yeah.
But actually. It might. I don't know. You know, I might have to play around with this one.
Yep.
I don't know how. You know, it kind of. I mean, if somebody's out there that can tell us that it's not like weird. I mean, think about a guy going over on a rope. You know, and trying to pick somebody off and that sort of thing. And you know how unsafe that could be. There was also a raise. It was called, I think, the factory raise. And a factory raise, you take the ground ladder and you put it very close to the building so people can climb down on both sides of the ladder.
Oh.
That's a factory raise. You know, because so, say you have people on three different floors. Well, if you put the ladder close enough to the building, people on the lower floor can grab the ladder on the inside. While people on the upper floors grab the ladder on the outside. You know, now if you actually had this below grade thing, you know, and you lowered a ground ladder on ropes, would somebody be able to grab that ladder and then work their way to the? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Interesting concept. Definitely an interesting concept, but it really is has nothing really to do with the church raise. It's sort of like, you know, it's sort of just like a suspended ladder,
right?
You know, but. I don't know. You know, it's almost like, what if you did something like that off a roof, right?
No.
Somebody, you know, rather than a pickoff, you lower a ladder down to them on a rope, you know, like you secure the both sides of the ladder, and then you just sort of push it down the side of the building, and the person just gets on the ladder, and then you pull the ladder back up. I don't know. It would be on the inside of the ladder.
Yeah,
that's the only problem, you know?
You scare me, Avillo.
I'm just thinking. You know, I don't know if anybody ever thought of that,
but it may be
absolutely ridiculous. And you know, maybe I'm just getting old, but I don't know.
I'm getting old. You're getting older.
I don't know.
One of the things
so 3 months in a row,
about,
nobody has the trivia.
Right. One of the great things about the fire service, though, is we adapt and we overcome. We meet many problems. We meet many problems that we never trained for. And if you go way back, if you've been around as long as I have and you have, we never had high-angle people. We never had rescue corps or rescue training. We were firefighters, and we figured out how to do haul systems later on.
Right.
In New York City, I told a friend of mine who was hoping was going to call tonight, but he is working, so obviously they're busy tonight. The rescue people were doing swift water rescue. They were doing high angle rescue. They were doing all this other stuff other than firefighting the night of the storm. Going way back when, we kept discovering, confined space. So we'll train for that. All these things we never knew. I'm thinking back when I was starting the fire service as a volunteer on Long Island in 1975 or 74, you went to fires. And if people were hanging off a cliff, you tied a lot. You didn't tie a knot. But now we're we have Z-rigs, 4-to-1 haul systems. We have prussic loops. We have prussic minding pulleys. We have carabiners. As we run into a problem we've never seen before, we come up with tools and techniques how to handle them differently.
Right.
In 1965, they were doing church raises. In 1970, whenever IFSTA published that particular edition, these were things how to solve problems. We used to think water curtains prevented exposure problems, but water curtains did zero. We have science on our side now, and we need to be looking at that science. The NIST studies, the NIOSH studies, the ATF studies on ventilation, all that stuff we need to be looking at. Not just saying, well, my brother said, if you tie a rope around this, you do that. We've grown up and we've gotten beyond that. And I think we should remain students of the fire service. Go to YouTube, go to fireengineering.com and other publication websites. There's a lot to learn, and it'll make us better at our craft, and we'll serve our citizens better. And more importantly, we'll serve each other better. And we need to keep that motivation up, to keep learning, keep expanding our knowledge. This storm taught me stuff that I never thought I would ever need living up here in New England. And, we have to keep learning because we're only going to hurt ourselves and the people we swore to protect if we don't.
Right. Well, storms and things like that bring out the best in people and
the
certainly
worst.
The best in the fire service.
And the worst, I saw people on Long Island selling generators for $2,000, too.
Yeah, and the worst, you're right, price gouging and all that sort of thing and people scamming and everything else. Yeah, absolutely. But, you look at the fire service, and, when I come on in the 80s, and I'm sure that's around the time, you might have been the 70s, but, we used to rappel on ladder belts.
Oh, yeah, with the three wraps.
Yeah, we used to rappel on ladder belts, how crazy was that, And we used to rappel, now like you sort of roll over the side, we used to rappel by just sort of standing straight up and stepping down to the side of the building. It was absolutely, if you really look at it now, it was crazy. Yeah. It was nuts because it just was so unsafe, but it was the best we had at that time,
You have to stop talking because most of the people listening to us have no idea what you're talking about. Describe a ladder belt to our listening audience.
Well, that's still a tool that we use, right? A ladder belt? A ladder belt is what you use on the aerial. It's that.
No, we got rid of them. Everything's regular harnesses now. We got rid of all those.
So most
of the country doesn't even know what you're talking about. You're talking about the 5-inch thick leather and cotton belt with the big giant carabiner hanging off it, right?
With a big hook on it,
yeah,
you would hook into the aerial on. You're right. I didn't even. Most people are wearing the gym tours now, and at the fire academies, we still use the ladder belts when guys go climb the ladders. We make them hook in and that sort of thing.
You don't even see them in Connecticut.
Really? Wow.
They're gone. So describe. My description is it's like a 4 to 6 inch belt you wear around your waist. It's got a couple of links and a chain. And then it's got a giant hook on it with a carabiner clip. Yeah. To rappel, you would wrap the rope around it three times, but you had to do it in the right direction. If you did it in the wrong direction, you would drop like a rock.
It would come out. Yeah, it would come out. Exactly.
And all you do is hold your hand behind your back, and the friction with the three loops would be good. If you were fat, you had to put four loops. If you were skinny, you had to put two loops. Or
and when I first came on, they didn't even have the carabiner sort of twist lock.
So was it an open hook?
It was a hook that you just pushed in. It was spring loaded, but there was
right,
no
that's
twist
what I
lock.
Had.
Yeah, yeah. There was no twist lock on it. You know, I mean, you know, I always say that Chief Flood used to say that when he got on a job, there wasn't a tetrahedron or a triangle. It was a fire V. They only had two parts to the fire sequence at that time, and then they found the triangle, and then finally the tetrahedron. But you know, when he came on, it was a fire V. That's how many years ago he was. But
it's interesting.
We could do a whole show on you know, tools and equipment of the past.
Yeah, I just water curtains, so many other things. But I do think the ladder belt, I knew a guy, Marty Dorber was his name. He could rappel out of a snorkel, and he could go upside down off of that ladder belt, and he could stop. And it's amazing that we even allowed this to happen. But he would.
Oh, we used to do that.
He would stop his helmet a foot from the ground, down 75 feet from the snorkel. And it was just
to
demonstrate how good he was. What were we doing?
I don't know. We'd have kids at, like, Fire Prevention Week.
Right.
And we'd put the aerial up, like, 90 feet with no belay line. And we had one single lifeline in Weehawken. And part of it, you know, had the kern coming out of the mantle on the rope. You could see it coming out. It was, like, bulging out. And that was sort of, like, right where the knot was. And I can remember being about 85 feet up and looking right at that and saying, man, I hope that thing doesn't break. And then I would rappel down to the ground, upside down, the whole thing. Same thing. Same exactly what we did.
Well,
it's crazy stuff, man.
The thing I have to say, thank God we grew up and we're watching out for each other. And it's not all about being macho and doing the right thing, what we thought was the right thing. We've learned risk versus benefit. We've gotten better. Yes, I've grown up. Here's my growing up experience. When I was a firefighter, I was very aggressive and maybe a little reckless. Then I became a lieutenant, and I was a little less reckless, but still pretty aggressive. Now I'm the guy with the white hat and the radio out in the street. Boy, oh boy, I became really, really conservative now that I'm responsible for all those people on the fire ground. You learn, you grow. We as a service, we learn and we grow. We're talking about injury prevention, we're talking about Maydays, RIT teams. We've grown up. We need to keep all that stuff going, and we need to keep it growing. I mean, I love what the Seattle guys, the Mike, you guys out there in Seattle, air management, I think that's the future of the fire service, and we should all read and pay attention to it. You know, I'm not saying we should hide under our fire trucks and squirt water from a mile away either. We need to do our job, but we've learned, and we have science on our side telling us how to do it better.
Well, you know, you temper safety with technology and common sense and all those things together sort of make the equation that sort of keeps you safe, you know. When you take all of those out of the picture and you have nothing but a full speed ahead mentality, you know, things start to get unsafe, you know. And, I mean, listen, we've beat that horse to death since we've been on the radio, you know. And hopefully we're making a difference out there a little bit, you know.
I think we are. The emails I get and the calls I get and people I meet in the street. Like I said, I taught in Tarrytown last week and he's talking about, we did this because of something Chief Abillo said. You know, and that stuff's great to hear. Tonight's show's not telling you how to be better. It's just this past 2 weeks' experience here on the Northeast Coast, and it's just been unbelievable. Things that I thought were so are not so, and things I thought would help us didn't help us. Bottom line, both in the fire service and in your personal life, if you're prepared, you'll do better. Like my home, I have a generator. My house is wired for a generator. I lost power last year for 4 days and then for 7 days after that. My brothers and sisters are, you know, know, going on now day 15 and 16 without power.
Wow.
You know, things like this, if you're prepared, you know, you have water, you have food, you have things or a place to go, you're going to do better. We as a fire service, if we have RIT teams, we're prepared for a firefighter to get trapped or disoriented, and we're ready to deal with that, we're going to do better. My learning experience of the last 2 weeks has been be prepared. Don't be surprised by storms. Don't be surprised by fires. Don't be surprised by accidents and injuries on the fire ground. Be ready for them. Prevent them. So you folks who are still suffering without power, you know, I'm going to say a prayer for you like I do every day for the last 2 weeks. It's been pretty horrible. I've seen the devastation myself. And you will get through this and things will get better. And I know in Jersey, Anthony, you guys are dealing with the same thing. For me, in my life, this is unprecedented. I've seen what I never imagined I would see.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, these are, you know, some of these things you could never thought. Again, you know, you go to, you know, the Staten Island and Brooklyn, the Jersey Shore, and you look at it and say, you know, man, I can't believe that this sort of devastation could actually happen. You know, it is, you know, it was, for us in New Jersey, it was the biggest natural disaster of our lifetime. You know, we're not going to see, you know, anything else like that. You know, I can't imagine anyway. You
know, almost turned Christie into a Democrat.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe it did. Maybe it did. I don't know. You know, like I said, you know, I don't agree with the way he's treating the fire service, but I do think he did a good job with this storm. And, you know, maybe Romney losing will put Christie into the front runner for the Republican nomination in 2016. I don't know. Who knows?
Not comment.
You know, but anyway, yeah, no comment, right? But anyway, Duff, listen, let's sign off because I feel like my head's going to explode. I got such a bad cold.
Yep. Well, you stay safe.
And,
thanks for tuning in.
Yep. And I don't know, everybody emails you. Nobody ever emails me, so I'm going to throw my email out there. It's
well, yes.
It's deputy with the number one at the end of it, deputyone@optonline.net. O, P as in Peter, T as in Thomas, online, all one word, .net. deputyone@optonline.net. Email me on anything you want, or just get to our Facebook page, and we'll certainly answer you.
Yeah.
And, you know, but that's my email, and I'm out there for anybody who needs me.
Yeah, that's, you know what, I hammer people on Facebook, and that's how I end up with all those emails. I hammer people, I pre-alert people about our radio show, although tonight we're probably going to have a low amount of listeners because I've been so busy going down to Long Island that I haven't been able to do what I normally do to promote our show. But that's where I end up getting it because I just hammer people and everybody I know about our show before we go live. So,
right.
You know, call us. Tell us what you want to talk about. Strategy, tactics, discipline, leadership, expectations. As you probably know by now, Anthony and I can talk about anything. So,
we can talk about how Notre Dame's going to win a national championship.
Yeah, that's good. As long as we don't talk about the New Jersey Giants or the New Jersey Jets. There's only one
no
team
Irish.
That plays in New York, and that's the Buffalo Bills. The rest of them play in Jersey.
What about the Yankees?
Oh, well, the Yankees. Baseball is easy. The Yankees. I mean, there's no discussion
there. It's only about maybe 12 weeks for pitchers and catchers.
Is it really? That's all it is? April 14th?
No, I don't know. I don't know.
It's April?
I don't know. Maybe 16.
As long as we're talking about April, FDIC, you folks, you need to be thinking about going to FDIC in Indianapolis. It's the greatest firefighter event every year, and I believe it'll continue to be that. Last year, there were 30,000 firefighters in Indianapolis to learn, network, and party. And it's, think about FDIC this April. Anthony,
good idea, Doug.
Yeah, you have two classes this year, right?
Yes, I'm doing a 4-hour and, you know, the short class. And, you know, basically the same that we do every year, you know. But I always look forward to going there. That's just a lot of fun. And, just, you know, you just see people, a lot of people you haven't seen in a while, and, you know, we're sort of in the loop there, you know, and it's like old home week in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and recharge your battery.
That's exactly right. Recharge your enthusiasm battery. Exactly. So, anyway, Duff, I will talk to you on the outside.
And just like
Duffy said, you know, listen, everybody out there, just keep on keeping on. That's what's going to keep us, that keeps us strong.
Yep. And until months, all you guys, listen, stay safe.
Bye, brother. Bye, American.
Hello. Bye, American. You know what? I didn't do my little promo this week. When you have a chance, buy American. It's what's going to beat us. It's going to keep us alive and keep this country going. I don't care if the Republican or Democrat, buy American. And it pays the taxes, pays the salary, and keeps guys working. Adios, muchachos.
All right, brother. Take care. Arrivederci.
Arrivederci. Arrivederci. Bye.
Those are my daughters.
Bye.
Bye, girls. It's a pleasure hearing from you. I hope you're all doing well. Love your dad.
Oh. All right. See you, Duff.
Bye, Duffy.
Bye, girls.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.